There are things out there. Creatures, monsters, ghouls, and spirits. Beings that fall outside the realm of visible truth, beyond the confines of our basic reality. They lurk in the dark, haunt the recesses of our minds, and stir our curiosity in the unusual and weird. They are taboo topics, stories that we tell around the campfire and folklore passed down from our ancestors. We've been taught that these things don't exist, that they are merely myth and legend. Or are they? Welcome to the Occult Archives. I'm your host and spooky librarian, E.M. Moon, but feel free to refer to me as E. Here lies a space beyond all spaces, a library full of arcane information enough to drive any normal person mad. If you can think of it, if you can question it, the archives probably have what you seek. Tonight I'm going to share with you a subject that most of us have heard of, even if we wish we hadn't. Demons. A word that most of us know, whether religious or not. A word that tends to strike fear in the hearts of those who hear it. The Bible talks about these servants of Satan and how they influence men to sin. But some have taken influencing to another level through what most would call demonic possession. But is there any merit to this idea? Any truth to the thousands of cases that have cropped up over the centuries across cultures throughout the world? Amityville, The Exorcist, a haunting in Connecticut, the exorcism of Emily Rose. All of these are purported to be true cases of demon possession and activity at their core, but are they just creative fodder for the literary and cinematic fire? Pure fiction from twisted minds? Or is there a terrifying truth to cases such as these? Demons have been a staple of many religions and folklore as long as man had the capacity to make a comparison between good and evil. From the jinn to the goddess Lilith, the name has been given to entities across time that never fell into the category of demons as we know them, based on Christianity, or more specifically, Catholicism. Now you can go on YouTube and type in demonic insert noun here, and get a whole slew of videos from across the world of supposed demonic encounters. They're in movies, on TV shows, in books, and across most of our lips at one point or another. But generally these beings are met with disbelief, even by the religious people that will swear to you they are real. Even the Catholic Church itself has extensive measures that they take before even considering an exorcism. The devil and his minions are everywhere, but are they really that interested in us? Depending on who you ask and based on the criteria symptoms, some may tell you the erratic, unusual behavior of someone is mental illness, while others may immediately jump to more sinister spiritual conclusions. And even if the church verifies a possession and calls for an exorcism, that doesn't make demonic possession fact. There have been plenty of times where the exorcism of a person has caused their death, and then we have another topic entirely. But for now, let's focus on a few cases of demonic possession that most will agree are accurately labeled with plenty of witnesses and encounters that were documented to the best of the ability of all those involved. The movie The Exorcist hit theaters in 1973 and shocked the hell out of audiences. It starred a fairly young Linda Blair as Regan, a teenage girl who messes around with a Ouija board and ends up being possessed by demons, then subsequently undergoes a full-blown exorcism. I won't spoil the ending for those that haven't watched it, but find it if you can and give it a go. It can be pretty rough shit for some, so view with caution. The Exorcist was probably what started it all as far as the demonic possession bandwagon, and both intrigued and terrified people, but the thought that possession like this could be a reality was fascinating. Regardless, there are those that have lived, and the story of The Exorcist wasn't entirely fiction, but based on a factual account surrounding a boy with the pseudonym Robbie Mannheim or Roland Doe. If it wasn't for author William Peter Blatty's best-selling novel, The Exorcist, based off of the unofficial diaries of Halloran and Bowdern, two priests involved in the exorcism, and an article written in the Washington Post in 1949, we may have never known about this bizarre and terrifying story. From what we can gather, Doe was an only child in a German Lutheran family who lived in Cottage City, Maryland in the late 1940s, 1949. Since the case is shrouded in anonymity for the boy and his family for the most part, we don't have a lot of details about who he was in his life before the possessions began. But we do know that their last name was supposedly Hunkeler, if I'm saying that correctly. The story is that the boy, being an only child, was dependent on the adults for playmates and became quite attached to his Aunt Harriet, a spiritualist, who introduced the boy to the Ouija board when he expressed interest in it himself. Let me stop for a second. I'm sure we've all heard it. Ouija boards are a gateway to hell and demons. Do not play, do not pass go, do not collect $200, or you are surely set to be possessed by demons of hellfire and brimstone. And that's pretty much where this case is going. Poor little Robbie got a hold of a Ouija board, and demonic chaos ensues. I'm someone who has been using a Ouija board in my craft over the last 15 years, and not once have I ever been possessed. I have seen strange and erratic behavior from other folks, but nothing to the extent in this story. One does not just catch a possession, but generally has to be vulnerable to occupation from such entities. Please don't be afraid of Ouija boards, and use caution if you decide to use one. There is plenty of good information out there on the internet, and I'm sure I will be doing an episode in the future about them, but I digress. In this story, the supposed initial cause of the demonic possession was the opening of a gate or portal by using the Ouija board that allowed an entity to come through, an entity who easily latched itself onto a prepubescent boy. The account was recorded by a Thomas B. Allen, an author, based on one of the last surviving Jesuit priests to witness the exorcism, Father Walter H. Halloran. But according to Allen, nothing really started to happen to the boy and his family until after Aunt Harriet passed away. It all started off simple enough, with strange noises like scratching in the walls and phantom water dripping. Moving furniture and everyday items such as a vase were flung or levitated whenever Doe was nearby. Of course, being a religious family, they turned to their Lutheran pastor, Miles Schultz, for assistance. Schultz was an interesting one. Not only a Lutheran pastor, but also a person with a very long interest in parapsychology. Because of this, he was able to arrange for the boy to spend the night in his home in order to observe him and the supposed activity. Apparently, he witnessed some crazy shit, because parapsychologist J.B. Ryan stated that Schultz claimed he witnessed household objects and furniture that seemingly moved on their own accord, but wondered if Schultz unconsciously exaggerated some of the facts. Regardless, Schultz advised the boy's parents to see a Catholic priest. I don't know how long the period was between the activity starting and when the pastor told them it was time to see a priest, but I would assume there was a damn good reason that Schultz decided that this was out of his league and they needed to call in the big dogs. He either really believed or he was fearful of the boy's behavior if it were to escalate. With demonic possession or oppression, there are a lot of symptoms that go along with it that could technically be explained away as symptoms of mental illness. But then there are some things that just can't be explained even by a rational mind. Things like furniture moving and levitating, unexplained sounds and smells, unusual behavior for the oppressed, accidents, and even unexplained deaths. If it goes on for long enough, the possessed have been reported to speak in a different voice or language not previously known to them, hold almost supernatural strength, and exhibit moments of psychic activity in the form of knowing things about others around them that they shouldn't. At that point, it is outside the realm of explainability and generally gets classified as possession, even if those involved are still fully skeptical. How else to explain stuff like that? According to what we know from the original story, the boy underwent a number of exorcisms, one of which was conducted by Edward Hughes, a Roman Catholic priest at Georgetown University Hospital, a Jesuit institution. During the exorcism, there were allegations that the boy was able to slip one of his hands free from his restraints. He managed to break a bedspring from under his mattress and used it as an improvised weapon, slashing the priest's arm. This action resulted in a halt of the exorcism ritual. Let's stop again for a second. If these accounts are true, there is a possibility that your average skeptical listener hears this and thinks, that sounds like someone is suffering from a psychotic episode. And maybe 7 out of 10 times they are probably correct. But there was something about this case and the boy's behavior coupled with the violent activity that caused priests to push for him to get more urgent help. Can you imagine how his parents felt? How he felt? If the possession is the truth and he was helpless inside his body while the supernatural force took him over completely? The facts are fuzzy, but supposedly scratches appeared on the boy's body that formed the word Lewis. The family then decided to travel to St. Louis, where the boy's cousin contacted one of his professors at St. Louis University, Bishop, who then in turn spoke to William S. Bowdern, who was an associate of College Church. Together, both priests visited the boy and his relative's home, where they too allegedly witnessed a shaking bed, flying objects, the boy speaking in a guttural, unnatural voice, and finally exhibiting an extreme aversion to anything sacred in a religious sense, like the Holy Rosary. He even urinated on himself and started cursing at the priests. Because of this scene, Bowden was granted permission from the Archbishop to perform yet another exorcism on the boy. This exorcism took place at the Alexian Brothers Hospital in South St. Louis, Missouri, which was later destroyed. Before this next exorcism ritual began, yet another priest, Walter Halloran, was called to the psychiatric wing of the hospital, where he was asked to assist Bowden in the rite. William Van Rue, a third Jesuit priest, was also there to assist the others. Halloran stated that during this time, words such as hell and evil, along with various other marks, appeared on the 13-year-old's body. Supposedly during the Litany of Saints portion of the exorcism, the boy's entire mattress began to shake. On top of everything, Doe broke Halloran's nose during the process. Later, Halloran told a reporter that after the rite was said and done, Doe went on to lead a rather ordinary life. Allen, in his 1993 book, Possessed, The True Story of an Exorcism, stated, "The consensus of today's experts was that Robbie was just a deeply disturbed boy, nothing supernatural about him." So what the hell really happened? Was Doe actually possessed, or just playing the long game in an act of ultimate teenage rebellion? Because this was before the day of fancy recording equipment and portable video cameras, the only information we really have to rely on is that of supposed eyewitnesses under a thin veil of possible religious fallacy. Another author, Mark Opoznasnik, questioned many of the supernatural claims made by the priest and family associated with the story, proposing that Doe was nothing more than a disturbed, spoiled little bully who threw deliberate tantrums so that he could get attention or out of school. Sounds rather plausible to me, considering he was an only child. Opoznasnik also reported that Halloran, who was present at the exorcism, never actually heard the boy's voice change, and he thought the boy simply mimicked the Latin words that he had heard the clergyman say, rather than magically gaining the ability to speak the language itself. Opoznasnik reported that when the marks were found to have suddenly appeared in the boy's body, Halloran failed to check the boy's fingernails to see if they were long or ragged, possibly making the marks on himself. He also questioned Hugh's stories of attempts to exorcise the boy and his subsequent injury, saying that he could find no such evidence that any sort of episode or injury had even occurred. But during Opoznasnik's investigation, he discovered that the exorcism did not take place at 3210 Bunker Hill Road in Mount Rainier, Maryland. The boy never lived in Mount Rainier. The boy's home was in Cottage City, Maryland. Much of the commonly accepted information about this story is based on hearsay, is not documented, and was never fact-checked. There is no evidence Father E. Albert Hughes visited the boy's home, had him admitted to Georgetown Hospital, requested that the boy be restrained at the hospital, attempted an exorcism of the boy at Georgetown Hospital, or was injured by the boy during an exorcism, or at any other time. There is ample evidence refuting claims that Father Hughes suffered an emotional breakdown and disappeared from the Cottage City community. Also, according to Opoznasnik, those individuals connected to the incident were probably influenced by their own specializations. To psychiatrists, Rob Doe suffered from mental illness. To priests, this was a case of demonic possession. To writers and film or video producers, this was a great story to exploit for profit. Those involved saw what they were trained to see. Each purported to look at the facts, but just the opposite was true. In actuality, they manipulated the facts and emphasized information that fit their own agendas. Opoznasnik wrote that after he had located and spoken with childhood friends and neighbors of the boy, he concluded that the boy had been a very clever trickster who had pulled pranks to frighten his mother and to fool children in the neighborhood. Skeptic Joe Nicol wrote that there was simply no credible evidence to suggest the boy was possessed by demons or evil spirits. He also maintains that the symptoms of possession can be childishly simple to fake. He dismissed suggestions that supernatural forces made the scratches or markings on the boy, or caused words to appear on his skin in unreachable places, saying, "A determined youth, probably even without a wall mirror, could easily have managed such a feat, if it actually occurred. Although the scratch messages proliferated, they never again appeared on a difficult-to-reach portion of the boy's anatomy. There was even an incident where the boy was reportedly seen scratching the words Hell and Christ on his chest by using his own fingernails." According to Nicol, Nothing that was reliably reported in the case was beyond the abilities of a teenager to produce. The tantrums, trances, moved furniture, hurled objects, automatic writing, superficial scratches, and other phenomena were just the kinds of things someone of R's age could accomplish, just as others have done before and since. Indeed, the elements of poltergeist phenomena, spiritual communication, and demonic possession, taken both separately and especially together, as one progressed to the other, suggests nothing so much as role-playing involving trickery. Nicole also dismissed any stories of the boy's extraordinary strength, saying he showed nothing more than what could be summoned by an agitated teenager, and he criticized popular accounts of the exorcism for what he termed a stereotypical storybook portrayal of the devil. These authors really did their research well, but where are their credentials to critique a case in this way? Demonic possession or mental illness, both possibly outside their realm of expertise. But they reported like skeptics do, and their evidence could suggest that what they believe is actually truth. Two Christian academics, Terry D. Cooper, a professor of psychology, and Cindy K. Epperson, a professor of sociology, wrote that advocates of possession believe that although they are not frequent, exorcisms are necessary for casting out the demonic, and cases of genuine possession cannot be explained by psychiatry. Cooper and Epperson seem to dismiss any natural explanations in favor of a more supernatural perspective in regards to the nature of evil. Not a lot of chatter from the church on this. At this point, the case is old enough that those alive then are probably deceased, and over time, especially that much time, stories like these tend to mutate and take on a life of their own. There have been paranormal investigators who have visited the old house on Roanoke Drive to try to see if any demon energy resides at the residence. Most notably, Ghost Adventures did a huge investigation involving the house, but the evidence was lacking, in my opinion, and probably Hollywood inflation, if you know what I mean. The exorcisms didn't even happen there, and that's where people start to confuse reality with fiction over time. The big exorcism in the movie happened in Reagan's house, but Doe wasn't at home. He was in the hospital when this was performed. See, things mutate and change as lives march on. So, what really happened to Roland Doe? Like most evidence in a lot of these sorts of cases, it is all based on eyewitnesses and hearsay, speculation, and lacking in any real physical proof. Just the diaries of two holy men, their biases skewed by the church, and possibly further pushed into the realm of the paranormal by a bratty adolescent. It's one of those cases where you kind of have to be a skeptic based on the information from both sides. When you look at it, the movie and book have more detail than the actual case itself. I guess it all depends on how you view the subject matter. But at this point, we won't ever really know the truth, and fiction tends to be more memorable anyway. Our second case started it all for another well-known horror film, The Exorcism of Emily Rose. But instead of an American farm girl, the real Emily, Annelise Michel, was from Germany. She grew up devoutly Catholic in Bavaria, West Germany, in the 1960s, where she attended Mass twice a week. The story begins when Annelise was 16 and she suddenly blacked out at school and began walking around, seemingly in a daze. However, she did not remember this event, though her friends and family noted that she was in a trance-like state. About a year later, Annelise experienced a similar episode, where she woke up in a trance and actually wet the bed. Her body then went through a series of seizure-like convulsions, causing her to shake uncontrollably. After this second occurrence, it was decided that the girl would visit a neurologist, who subsequently diagnosed her with temporal lobe epilepsy, a disorder that causes seizures, loss of memory, and the tendency to experience auditory or visual hallucinations. Strangely enough, this sort of epilepsy can also cause something called Geschwind syndrome, another disorder marked by hyper-religiosity. After this diagnosis, Annelise began taking medication for her epilepsy and soon enrolled in the University of Würzburg in the year of 1973. Sadly, the drug failed to help her with her epilepsy, and as the year went on, her condition began to worsen. She continued to take her medicine, but she had started to believe that she was possessed by a demon and that she could somehow find a solution to this outside of her medicine. Annelise began to live her life in fear, claiming that she could see the face of the devil wherever she went and that she heard demons whispering to her. She prayed and prayed, and during an instance of praying, she swore she heard the demons telling her that she was damned and would rot in hell. She concluded from this that the devil himself must be possessing her. Annalise went on the search for priests to aid her with her supposed demonic possession. However, all the clergy approached by her rejected to assist, urging her to get medical help instead, and that they needed the permission of a bishop to even help her anyway. At this point, her delusions had become extreme. Despite not really helping her, good on those priests for that, at least suggesting she seek medical attention for what sounded like delusions. Any sane person, whether skeptical or not, have to take these things with a grain of salt. From an outside perspective with no physical proof, I could see why they were reluctant to help her, especially because exorcisms are supposed to be used in very extreme measures. People have died because of them, as I stated earlier. Despite all of this, Annalise still thought she was possessed. She would tear all the clothes from her body and compulsively perform up to 400 squats a day. Remember that creepy-ass scene in The Exorcism of Emily Rose where she is in her room leaping up from her shins and then down again? Yeah, think like that. She also crawled under a table and barked like a dog for 2 days and ate spiders and coal, which is another scene from the movie where they find her eating insects. She also bit the head off a dead bird and even licked her own urine from the floor. From the perspective of any typical person, she appeared to be severely mentally ill. Eventually, she and her mother found a priest, Ernst Alt, who actually believed that she was truly possessed and not suffering from some sort of mental illness. He stated that she didn't look like an epileptic in later court documents involving the case, whatever the hell that means, because seizures were the least of her problems at this point. Annalise wrote to Alt, "I am nothing. Everything about me is vanity. What should I do? I have to improve. You pray for me." And she also once told him, "I want to suffer for other people, but this is so cruel." An official exorcism could not be performed without permission, so Alt petitioned the local bishop, Bishop Joseph Stengel, who eventually approved the request and granted a local priest, Arnold Renz, permission to perform an exorcism, but ordered that it be carried out in total secret and mentioned to no one. Over the next 10 months, following the approval of the bishop, Alt and Renz conducted 67 exorcisms, lasting up to 4 hours, on poor Annalise. Through these exorcisms, Annalise revealed that she was actually possessed by possibly 6 demons. Lucifer, Cain, Judas Iscariot, Adolf Hitler, Father Valentin Fleischmann, and Nero. All of these supposed spirits would fight for power over Annalise's body and would communicate from her mouth with a low growl. It's not hard to do a Google search for recordings of her exorcism, and they are actually truly spine-chilling, but I will also play a bit for you here. This clip starts with what Annalise sounded like prior to the possession and then goes through the supposed voices of each demon in this order: Hitler, Cain, Nero, Fleischmann, Judas, and Lucifer. What you are going to hear may be disturbing to some. The recording is a little over 3 minutes long, so feel free to mute the volume for a bit or fast forward.
Ja, ich will auch für die anderen leiden, damit die nicht näher kommen und so. Aber dass das dann so schlimm ist und so grausam und so furchtbar, nee. Das denkt man leiden, das ist so, so leicht zu haben. Wenn es dann wirklich schlimm wird, da will man überhaupt nicht mehr, da will mein Kind schlimm.
Nein, ihr Klötze! Der Maul, ihr Klötze! Oh, so ein Jahr, der will auch nicht, oh, ich geh auch nicht, oh!
Sind wir schon drei?
Ah, wie? Was ist so eine Schneise?
Nur Hass.
Ja, Ja.
Und wo du Hass ist, da gibt's keine Ruhe.
Nein! Und für uns gibt's nie Ruhe. Nie!
Weil
ich Gott! Die müssen in eigenen Seminaren ausgebildet werden, die dürfen nicht auf die anderen Universitäten. Kapiert?
Klar. Ist da sonst noch etwas zu sagen?
Weil
der Teufel größere Macht.
But 67 exorcisms. If you've ever read about exorcisms and intense demonic possession, you know, based off of physical evidence, how strenuous something like this can be on the human body, not to mention their psyche, especially if Annalise was mentally ill on top of that, whether she was actually possessed or not. The toll it could take on her would have been devastating. I don't know whether or not during this time if her family ever contacted a medical professional, because in my opinion, one should always be on hand during an exorcism unless they start to train the priests to be EMTs as well as demon killers. All of this sounds like a recipe for disaster to me, and it technically was. Apparently the demons argued with each other, with Hitler saying, "People are stupid pigs. They think it's all over after death. It goes on." And Judas saying Hitler was nothing but a big mouth, who had no real say in hell. Frequently throughout these sessions, Annalise would talk about dying to atone for the wayward youth of the day and the apostate priests of the modern church. She ripped the tendons and broke the bones in her knees from continually kneeling in prayer. Over these 10 months, remember that all 67 of these exorcisms were performed in only 10 months' time. Annalise was often restrained so that the priest could conduct their exorcism rites. Because of her episodes, Annalise had stopped eating and she eventually died of malnutrition and dehydration on July 1st, 1976. She was only 23 years old. What's even more messed up is that after her death, Annalise's story became a national sensation in Germany after her parents and the two priests who conducted the exorcisms were charged with negligent homicide. They came before the court and even used recordings of the exorcism to try and justify their actions. The movie did a pretty great job with bouncing back and forth between the court scenes and the scenes of Emily slowly devolving into possession. Unfortunate or not, the two priests were found guilty of manslaughter resulting from negligence and were sentenced to 6 months in jail, which was later suspended, and 3 years of probation. The parents were exempted from any sort of punishment as they had suffered enough. Supposedly a criteria for sentencing in German law. Other than inspiring a horror film, Annalise became sort of an icon for some Catholics who felt like modern secular interpretations of the Bible were distorting the ancient supernatural truth that it contains. Franz Barthel, who reported on the trial for the regional daily paper The Main Post, remembers, "The surprising thing was that the people connected to Mikkel were all completely convinced that she had really been possessed. Buses often rolled from Holland, I think, still come to Annalise's grave," Barthel says. "The grave is a gathering point for religious outsiders. They write notes with requests and thanks for her help and leave them on the grave. They pray, sing, and travel on." It's almost as if Annalise has reached this strange level of quasi-sainthood. Because why? She died as a martyr to demonic possession, a death that could have possibly been prevented had she been taken to the hospital and put under medical care. Even if the priest continued to be with her, she would have still been monitored by medical professionals. While the movie really chilled me and fucked with my head, because yeah, demons are plausible if not downright real to me, and even if I am a skeptic, I don't know what I would have thought had I been a juror on that trial. I have listened to the recordings dozens of times, and the sound, the tone, and the pitch of her voice makes your skin crawl. When you look at the pictures of her, what she looked like before it all started to the hollow, brittle shell of her former self at the end, it makes you emotional. But was she really possessed, or just severely mentally ill? Had they gotten her medical care, would she still have died? Or could she have possibly survived? When all of this started for Annalise, she was around the average age that schizophrenia starts to manifest. Was Annalise actually a severe paranoid schizophrenic with religious delusions and hallucinations instead? We won't ever know the actual truth, despite the eerie and upsetting evidence in this instance. There's a common denominator here for me, and something I see a lot on demonic possession cases. The victims of the possession are all highly religious, if not Catholic, in their religious beliefs. Is that a prerequisite? I know there have been cases out there that involve non-religious or non-believers, but you don't hear about them as much. Is their religious devotion actually a vulnerability? It's truly scary to think that invisible beings made of pure evil and hellfire who lurk on the fringes of reality exist, just waiting for us to let our guard down so they can take up residence inside our bodies and completely take over. All it takes is just a little crack. Or are demons just inside our heads, just like people talk about having inner demons? Are these episodes of possession just merely a manifestation of some aspect of a person's personality caused by some sort of mental illness or act of defiance and lashing out? I don't know. The supernatural and paranormal are tricky like that. There are a lot of similarities in these two cases as far as behavior of the supposedly possessed, but maybe that is a coincidence, or maybe that is the diagnosis criteria for demonic possession. Either way, these instances actually happened, whether embellished or not, and they are just another page of a book on the shelf of the occult, another question of actuality or pure fabrication. What do you believe? I just want to give a big thank you to everyone who put up with my ramblings about the occult tonight. Without you, I'd just be sitting here telling stories to myself. But I'm so thrilled to be able to share these stories with all of you. I also want to publicly appreciate the hell out of my archive benefactors. You all gave me the boost I needed to get this podcast off the ground and through the airwaves. Serena Hamblin, Mary Bostick, Dee Brady, Ame Turner, Marina Bickford, and Jessica Washburn. You all are amazing, and I can't fully express how much it means to me that you support the podcast and the archives. Join us on October 28th, my birthday, for episode 2, The Black-Eyed Children. And remember, it's okay to sleep with the lights on. Theme music for the Occult Archives by JunkFood2121. Background music by Purple Planet Music, and other sound effects by Zap Splat and Julius Mabe.